com. Check out store.hellovanessamedia.com. Subscribe on Rumble, YouTube, follow on podcasting platforms, follow on Twitter, LinkedIn, and TikTok. Hi, my name is Vanessa, and today's video slash podcast are going to be about military spouse national licensing legislation. Military spouse licensing legislation in a specific state, specifically Massachusetts, just passed a law. I'm going to be talking about military spouse occupational licensing in their state, as well as some other topics, and also about basically the military pay. Okay, so here goes. So I've been tracking, if you've been listening to my podcast or videos at all, about for a while now, there is a massive piece of legislation that has been introduced by Mike Garcia, a representative out of California. And if you're on a platform that has a description enabled, just check out the description. I've linked in several links. If you're interested in this topic, you will be very interested in checking out. And it provides basically more information to some of the things that I'm referencing. Not all, but some. Anyways, so Mike Garcia is a representative from California, and he has introduced a piece of legislation which is intended to basically allow for the portability of occupational professional licenses of military spouses to travel with them whenever they relocate with their active duty military service member spouse. And this isn't the only time I've heard of something like this. There are representatives that may have co-sponsored this as well, I'm not sure, or drafted and sponsored a similar piece of legislation elsewhere that were representatives out of Utah, I recall. So this has been a talking point and something that has been floated as legislation for at the federal level for a while now. But the reality is that this is generations overdue. In America, we're a credentialist society, meaning that you pretty much need, in many cases, some type of credential, whether it be a diploma, a certificate, a license, a certification, some kind of, you know, documentation demonstrating competency in a certain area in order to even work in your own business potentially in certain areas, as a skilled tradesperson or a licensed professional of some other type. Whatever the case, it's very common to need a credential. Credentials such as certifications and licenses are oftentimes regulated by individual states, and that's where it gets really tricky, because from there, the states can and will arbitrarily make up rules and deny people the right to work essentially in that state, despite having credentials in another state demonstrating competency and skill and work experience. And that work experience, skill, and competency could span 20 plus years, and they could still end up being denied the right to work in another state. I've seen this happen, observed it firsthand. It's wild. It's wild to watch someone who is a skilled professional and needed an occupation in that community to be denied the right to work because of some arbitrary regulatory red tape type reason, and then have to switch occupations after 20 plus years just because they relocate. This is an issue that affects not just the military, but really the entire nation. Anyone, regardless of military affiliation, if they cross state lines and have a credential that they would like to utilize, that credential almost instantly becomes useless to them, and they have to go through this massive bureaucratic red tape nonsense process to attempt to have that credential recognized. It is ludicrous what people are required to go through, and it's really harmful to the public interest in America, no doubt about it. But that's the reality of it. Now, the licensed nurses, they really have it together, it seems like. I'm not an expert in that area, but what I do understand is they have something called the Nurses Compact. And basically, it appears from the outside looking in that nurses are able to have portability with their licenses. So if they work in, you know, Washington State, then they should be able to go to Florida State and work with that license. That's my understanding of it. Again, I'm not an expert in that area, but I know I've heard a lot of licensed professionals expressing jealousy and kind of being envious of licensed nurses' compact agreement throughout the U.S. because it is so so innovative, and it makes a lot of sense that you would want to work as a nation within the states to make sure that your licensed professionals can provide services and meet the demand for services all across the nation publicly. And it's unrealistic to expect any person to stay in one state their entire life and never want to maybe relocate later on down the road, 5 years later, 10 years later. Who knows? Life happens. People get married, people get divorced, people have children, people retire. A lot of things change in people's lives that could lead to relocation, not just being in the military. However, this is specific for the military, and I'm definitely reporting back on it today because the reality is that it has passed committee markups, is how it was reported in the news. And now, next month, which I'm guessing they mean September, because this is August right now, it's anticipated that this legislation, the military spouse legislation for the national licensing bill, will be voted on in the House. Now, if that's the final vote, I'm not quite sure. This has been pending for over a year already, is my understanding. So I don't know if there's going to be more to it after that month, if there's going to be, you know, more voting required, if that's the final vote, if people will vote for it, against it. It seems like most things are not voted on unanimously at all, so we'll see what happens. And most interestingly, I want to see the final version of this bill, because if it is not strictly written with complete enforcement ability, I guarantee you that states across the nation, some of them, are the regulatory boards, are going to find the loopholes and swim right through them. And then you're going to have military spouses with the exact same problem, meaning that they just cannot get their credentials recognized and honored. And so they're going to be facing the same issues with employment as they've been facing for generations now. Which takes me to my next point. So there's something called, it's referred to as a SPEED Act in Massachusetts. It just became law. And speaking of unanimous votes, to my shock, their legislature actually unanimously voted for this. And basically what it includes is several things. The first thing that I'm most interested in is military spouse licensing. They claim that they're very military friendly now, and that a spouse of active duty service member relocating there due to, you know, military service will be able to have their occupational professional license or licenses recognized there. However, I highly doubt that to be the case, and this is the reason. So this is a direct quote from the law itself, and I believe it's a loophole for regulatory boards. It says, quote, providing notification to the applicant that the applicant's experience does not satisfy the requirements for licensure and specify the criteria or requirements that the applicant failed to meet and the basis for that determination. Okay, and I also link this if you're on a platform where there's a description so you can read the full bill. It's quite lengthy. And there were other similar bills as well. So it was very confusing, the Massachusetts legislature website, but this is what I read and of the, what I believe may be a loophole. And what I'm thinking is that basically these regulatory organizations are still going to be able to say, for example, a person with a license for mental health counseling is in XYZ state and they require 2,000 supervised work hours for that, which by the way, costs like thousands of dollars for people to obtain in most cases. Like, this is not cheap, easy, or free. All right, so they do that. They have their license. They go over to, let's say, Massachusetts. I'm just making this up. I don't know what the requirements are. Let's just say Massachusetts hypothetical requirements are 3,000 hours instead of 2,000. Well, now, based upon what I'm reading, they could just say, oh, well, you don't meet the criteria because you're 1,000 hours short, and so you got to start all over again. This happens all the time throughout the U.S. I've actually watched this happen to military spouses, and they've been disenfranchised from being able to work as a result. I've also seen and listened to boards tell me, because I've inquired about transfer, trying to have my credentials recognized somewhere else, that, well, you know, this state requires XYZ course, okay, in grad school. And we require a BC course in grad school. And it could be literally like the most similar course, but they want to nitpick and say, oh, well, the syllabi doesn't say it's the exact same description. So in order to be qualified, you have to retake that class, go back to grad school, spend thousands of dollars so that we can qualify you as being worthy of having your credential recognized. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that they pull all across the US and these states, regardless of different types of licenses, okay? I've seen this stuff firsthand. And so what you have is you have, whether it be a military spouse, but I'm just focused on military spouses here. Military spouses typically mainly be in a location for 2 to 3 years, okay? Maybe longer, but a lot of times it may only be 2 to 3 years or less. By the time they spend thousands of dollars that they don't have to spend and years meeting all these regulatory board requirements that are so important for the quote public interest to be protected, right? By the time they get done with that, they won't even have a chance to work. They're going to be at the NOCS location with their service member. So now they're out thousands of dollars trying to meet these regulatory requirements, years of their life trying to meet these regulatory requirements, countless hours of their life filling out paperwork, trying to jump through fiery hoops of hell, all for nothing. Okay. And then you get to the next state and they're going to want to do the same thing more likely than not, because most states, this is the way they're operating. The only state that I've seen that is truly military friendly is Utah. Utah has something called true recognition. They actually will recognize the licenses of military spouses that are there because of their spouse's active duty military service. You can go to Utah, you can check out their professional licensing organization, you can see what I mean. They even have an auto-generated letter talking about recognizing professional licenses that you a person that's eligible could download and provide to an employer. I found this to be very interesting. I studied this with regard to specifically social work. However, it appears based upon the Department of Labor's website, which I did a video on that way back when. You can check that out somewhere in my backlog of videos. It appears that they have that attitude. It's listed by Department of Labor with all professional licenses, not just one type. Again, you'll need to check and do your homework on this. These things are constantly changing. But the last time I checked, that's the way it was. Now, I've had my eye on Utah for, at this point, years. I want to say a couple of years, because I'm so intrigued by how friendly they are. And even if you're not a military spouse, it appears that transferring a license to Utah, a professional license, is much easier compared to other states. Now, other states claim to be military friendly, but if you really get into the weeds and look at their professional licensing laws, you'll quickly see that it's not what it seems, that there's all these extra requirements added in. And once again, once you get through with all of them, you're spending a lot of money and a lot of time, and it may not even be something that will work out for the person. So I am hoping that the national legislation, if and when it passes, will not have any of these loopholes like I think I see in the Massachusetts law, where, you know, spouses still will be disenfranchised. All right, so this brings me to my next thing that I wanted to mention. So I actually posted on I don't know if it's been released yet, actually. I think it's scheduled to be posted on my Twitter, at Tweet2Vanessa with the number 2, and on my LinkedIn. You can check that out. Follow me there if you want. I've got the links everywhere for that. But basically, the Institute for Justice has a really robust YouTube channel, and they're an organization that works for the public interest. They consider themselves a public interest law firm, is what they said about themselves. I've watched many of their videos, very interesting work that they do. There are a lot of lawyers, obviously, that work there, and their work to further the public interest as they see it. And there was one particular video that I, you know, saved basically to share. And it's entitled "Mental Health Professional Sues New York for the Right to Teleconference with Client." So this person is some type of licensed mental health professional. And I forget her exact credentials. And basically, she's not affiliated with the military, to best of my knowledge, but she's licensed as a mental health professional in one state. I forget which one. And basically, just like is very common in America, you know, you may have a person that's receiving services from a, let's say, a mental health care or even a healthcare professional, but in this case, mental health care professional. They relocate to another state, or they may travel to another state for work. But once that happens and they leave the state, there's various laws in these different states that prevent mental health professionals, as well as others, I'm sure, but mental health professionals in this case we're talking about, from being able to continue that work with that client. It gets really hairy with the legal stuff. So the Institute for Justice basically took up the case. And I listened to the video, I looked at it, I actually reached out to them to see where the case was at, because this was about a year ago that they posted this video. And I have no idea whatever became of it. I don't know if it settled, if the person won, was. I have no idea what the status of it is. But basically the premise of it was that this was about a First Amendment right to free speech type issue for the mental health clinician to be able to talk with her clients across state lines. So I don't know whatever became of that, but the core issue, as far as I see it, is the same issue that I'm talking about throughout this video slash podcast and I've been talking about, which is this just regulatory nonsense across the US limiting licensed professionals from being able to work with people, despite being trained and licensed and credentialed and all the things in another state, and it being basically very difficult, if not impossible, to continue the same work, even with the same person that they've been working with across the state lines. And so this is the first time I've seen any professional really take on these regulatory institutions of any kind. I mean, that's like a real daunting kind of task from my perspective. So I would love to see whatever becomes of that. I'd like to see if more professionals decide to take on regulatory organizations about these issues. I don't know if they will, but I certainly would be watching it if they did. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was Mike Garcia. I was trying to find the news article because I curate my news daily to kind of get notifications about the issues that I really want to learn more about, which are not widely reported on the national news media. And typically the news I'm looking at are from local news media outlets all across the nation doing the Lord's work, reporting on very important issues that impact the public interest and people's lives that just aren't being reported on really at all. And so a small local newspaper, it looked like in California, had reported that Mike Garcia, this California representative they keep mentioning, had gone to a military base out there. I think it was an Air Force base, if I remember correctly, and spoken to some military commanders about the national pending military spouse occupational licensing legislation. And I was very surprised by what one or more of these commanders said that got out to the news media and was printed. And basically what they said was approximately one third of the military, I don't know if they meant the Air Force, but I'm thinking the whole military probably, because they're all on the same pay scale, are below the poverty line. And that basically a full-grown adult with a full-time income is needed to raise the approximately one-third of the military above the poverty line. So that is the first time I've seen an admission like that ever in writing. I've known for a long time that there is a segment of the military severely underpaid. It's really been listed side. And, you know, when I was in the military, which I got out 10 years ago now, I remember early on in a training experience where there was this little cadence that was said, and it had something to effect of, you know, they give you, like the government gives you $10 and takes away $9. I didn't understand what that meant, but I do now. So basically, the way the system, when I was in, I'm speaking from direct experience, was designed, was that the uniforms were very low quality and were made to not last very long with these contracts, it appears, that they had with Department of Defense. But the service member, myself, were required to pay this premium cost for uniforms that would be fraying almost immediately, falling apart at the seams, ill-fitting, not good quality. And it everything was always upcharged above and beyond what you could get in the civilian world, something comparable. You know, that was what I saw happening. I remember being put in barracks that I used to joke and say it was an asbestos-filled shoebox. It literally was. It was like the size of a shoebox, a human shoebox. I mean, like, to live in. You know, it was so small. I shared a bathroom with someone else. Quite frankly, that barracks was nicer than what some of the other people were staying in. I was only there 6 weeks before I ended up relocating. Not going to give you the story on that. And they ended up being condemned. The barracks I was living in ended up being condemned shortly after and bulldozed. They were from World War II, and I don't have a problem with historic buildings at all, but the money that was taken out of my check was not commensurate with what I was receiving whatsoever, and I had no choice at all in my housing, at all. I ended up being able to, I lived in a few places during the years that I was in this location where I was at, and the final location I stayed at, which would have been a comparable, like, comp of the housing on base, literally was way nicer, spacier and everything. And it cost 1/3 of the money they were taking out of my check. Okay. So that should give you some perspective here of what's going on with the money. And I don't know where that money was going. I know that there were civilians that were managing the barracks. I had nothing against them. I got along with them. They were very nice to me. But the money, you know, I think it's enough said with that. So you know, on the enlisted side, the money is not what it should be. It never has been. It's particularly bad with the junior enlisted, E5 and below. It gets really bad with single service members. I remember I was in, like, literally it was poverty wages. Like, it was complete poverty. I did not understand that before I joined because they don't explain that. And quite frankly, I had a great recruiter the second time I joined. So I don't blame my recruiter, but I don't think that the recruiters are frequently trained, at least when I was coming in, to really explain these things properly. And I did not understand until I got to my duty station what was happening, you know. And I remember the pay being so poor during the time that I was in that I actually was looking actively and trying to get a second job due to my chain of command basically having extreme control over every aspect of my life. I wasn't allowed to do that. And so the money, it was just always a financial strain during the time I was in. Obviously, I did not stay in, and I'm glad I didn't. You know, also the retirements, the politicians have scaled that way down, and it was never that great to begin with, especially for the enlisted side. And so John Stewart made a comment, and I'm just going to paraphrase and censor it. But it was something to effect in his speech about the PACT Act 2022 initially being voted down before it got voted up, you know, about how these politicians have never met a veteran, and I would add service member, that they wouldn't, you know, bleep over. Yeah, that's basically what he said. And I'd have to agree with you. I remember when I was in, I was really shocked at how politicized the Department of Defense was. I'm appalled and disgusted at how these politicians constantly try to leverage the Department of Defense and also the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, which I've commented on quite a lot, to their political advantage for votes. There are some politicians I know that actually do care. I don't think that most do. They're very concerned about their donors. Those donors also may, in some cases, be getting contracts with the Department of Defense, in my humble opinion, which are, there's no poverty there. Okay. They're very expensive contracts. And also, you know, I remember when I was in, you know, the politicians talking about in Congress about finding new ways to cut our pay. You know, this was during the height of the war, you know, of different wars they're running in the Middle East with Iraq and Afghanistan. They didn't care. You know, I remember when I got out, them cutting benefits as well. you know, and those cuts have been permanent. I'm not even getting into all the specifics of that, so I don't get down a rabbit hole, you know. And so the politicians are constantly looking at service members, veterans, and their families as expendable ways to cut out of the budget, and do not value these humans nearly enough. And I'll just leave it at that. Okay, that's it for today. I wish you all the best. Bye. Check out HelloVanessaMedia.com. Check out store.HelloVanessaMedia.com. Subscribe on Rumble, YouTube, follow on podcasting platforms, follow on Twitter, LinkedIn, and TikTok.